Anita, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anita.
And I'd just like to say good evening to each and every one of you. And thank you, you know, ASCAPA for giving me this. It is an honor, you know. Who would think a drunk could come up here and say stuff, you know, and oh well. My sobriety date is September 21st, 2004. And I was born here in South Tucson. If you don't know where that's at, it's just about 5-10 miles from here. So I'm a native Tucsonan. And when I was born, it just felt like they told me that it snowed here in Tucson. And I was supposed to be like this love child of my mother and father were separated for 10 years. And I was born, and I was supposed to be, I don't know, love child of whatever, you know, South Tucson, and I I felt, you know, I just, that was just my, what they would tell me, how special I was, and, you know, after years of separation, you know, I wish, I don't know, I just didn't even feel like I was special, you know, I already felt like, you know, like I was already like a burden or something to my mom. And I have 8 brothers and sisters, but I was an only child because I was 10 years apart from them. And they were already going off and leaving, and I used to feel like abandoned. My mother and father were both alcoholics. And being Native American and growing up in an alcoholic, you know, environment, you just have to learn survival at a very fast rate. By 5 years old, my mom was telling me that she could die any day. You know, I'm going to die, so you better learn this right now. You know, she would grab me and tell me that. And I was only 5 years old, you know. And I didn't know. I didn't understand what she meant, you know. But, you know, years and years of physical and mental abuse like that, you know, I really didn't see any vision for me. Anything, you know. But my dad, when he would come in, and it'd be 2 in the morning, and I could hear my mom telling him, "Leave her alone, she's sleeping," you know. So I wonder now why I work graveyards. I wonder why that I'm up at 2 in the morning all the time. But then I remember, I mean, this just came at to me finally that, you know, I remember trying to wait for that car to come in for my mom to go, "Benita," you know. And drag her out of that car and put her in bed, you know. And I was only like 5-7 years old, old enough to hold someone. And, you know, that was my childhood, you know. But I was so fearful inside and enraged and disgusted, you know, that anger, you know. But I would never send it out, you know. And later on, you know, I was molested when I was little. And not just by one person, several people, not even of my family. And that played a big role in turning I never told anyone. I never told my father, my daddy. I never told him. I never told my mom because the shame and the guilt, you know. She'd probably say it was my fault. You know, she was a very powerful woman. Her voice could just tell you, you know, just by her voice, you could just, and even now, my children, they tell me, just by your tone alone, you know, I could just go under this carpet. And that's a lot that I feel now that I've researched stuff and found a little bit about myself with alcoholism, that, you know, I'm not such a, you know, a rare case. A lot of people had these problems in their families. There's a lot of, you know, dysfunction, you know. But out of this dysfunction, my dad would come from cells and take me on the weekends, and I would be so happy because he would tell me how special I was and that I was going to be something. And I was just happy when he would come. And I wish sometimes that I would be able to go with him. But that's just my delusion, because in reality, he was an alcoholic too. And he probably would have left me somewhere. My mom, she would, you know, that was back in the days when you could take kids to bars. And that was my first gig when I was like 4 or 5 years old. I remember Mission Valley singing because I learned the Pledge of Allegiance and I learned a little song. And all the bar just stood up and drinks for everyone. And I would get seven up with cherries in it. And that, I love that. You know, I love that feel of being the only one, on, you know, in this limelight. And my mom and dad would, you know, they would get their beer free. And, you know, I felt special. Later on did I know that later on that was where I was going to be comfortable at, in a bar. Well, as time went on, my mom would just leave me and my grandpa for like days. And I'd still go to school, but I'd have to learn how to open up a can to feed us. And I never knew about abandonment. I just always thought everything was rosy, you know. This is how everybody lives. This is how you raise your children. You know, I never knew all that would later engulf me and make me feel so awful and so loathsome, you know, and alone. And I was so scared when my mom would come in, you know, at 2 a.m. yelling for me. And, you know, when she was drunk in the backseat of the car, I always remember that AM, FM radio. And when there was no FM then, but I wish there was. And I would go to dances, and I would be just terrified in the back of the car, you know, just waiting to go home. And I promised myself I would never do any of this stuff to my children. I promised myself, you know, I'm going to be blah, 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 you know. I didn't want kids then, but I thought, you know, I'm not going to treat them like that. So my dad and mom used to drive drunk all the time, and, you know, I somehow make it to school, and they found out I was gifted and talented, you know, and I could play the guitar by 9. And my mom's alcoholism kind of ruined that for me because they would teach me like solos and then I couldn't go. And then I started learning how to lie. I would tell them that my mom had a heart attack, you know, and they go, oh, everything's okay, you know. And that was my first lie of being, you know, a victim of an alcoholic. And I found out that I could use my mind and connive people even when I was that little, you know. But as time went on, my father was still part of my life. But when I was 13 years old, he died. And my whole life just changed. No one ever told me I was special. No one ever told me that, you know, I was beautiful. My mom was just a raging drunk. She would never compliment me. So it was like I took care of myself and my grandpa, you know. It was just us two. And as time went on, when I was 13, I took my first drink then. I was still in honor society and stuff like that. And when I took that first drink, I just meant to go to this graduation party. And I got high and everything just, oh, was wonderful. I loved it, you know. I just loved it. Like, you know, my friends looked better. The world was just wonderful, you know. And I liked this. It was cool, you know. And I was like 13, but I still didn't know that I was, you know, that was gonna be like my career. But when I still was in honor society and you know, altered like higher level education, in the back of my humanities class I would be giving out, you know, liquor. And they didn't even know. Or maybe they did. But I used to think I was so clever. I was really smart. I can outsmart all these people. Through my high school years was just like a rock dream, you know, going to concerts, getting backstage, you know, getting high. But half that time I wouldn't even remember how I got backstage. I don't even remember what the bands were playing, you know. I think those were my first blackouts, you know. But somehow I got through that by God's grace. But I had a bigger vision of myself. I dreamt that I was going to go, and I still was trying to be in acting. And my mom, once again, God, that woman, she didn't allow me to perform. They told me that I could go audition for some movies, and she said, no, I'm not signing that waiver. I'm like, damn you. I couldn't even call her. I had so much respect for this woman that I couldn't even cuss at her. But finally, she just broke it, and I was like, fuck you. She's like, fuck you too. I mean, she's just right back with a quip. You know, I was like, I never could have the last word with her, ever. You know, I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know this was a disease. I didn't know anything about that back then. And I just thought my mom was a mean, mean woman, you know. And my sisters and brothers never came around, so I just felt alone, you know. They never came around, so I thought they hated me because Benita was always, like, you know, Benita was, you know, doing this and that, you know. But they never, like, encouraged me either. And I didn't know back then that my mom had wanted to isolate us so bad that she told them if they ever come to see me, that she would call the police on them. And I didn't know that till later on, you know, in my life. Yeah, while I was in rehab. My sisters told me all this. So I decided to go to California. And I was going to change everything when I went to California. I had a plan. I had a plan that I was become this actress, rock star, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I had a plan. You know, and I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to party no more. I'm nobody's sister. I'm nobody's daughter. It's just me, you know. But you know what? That geographical drinking went with me. And I ended up finding people that party like me. No, no, I'm going to go to school. No, I found people that party just like the people here in Tucson, you know. And I had still so low self-esteem. I went to cosmetology school, but I couldn't even get my license to drive. It took me till 21 to get my license because I could still hear my mom telling me what a loser I am, what a whore I am, you know. And I didn't even go for my cosmetology license when I finished beauty school because I constantly heard myself, you're a loser, you're not going to make it, you know. With all this, you know, I had a lot of blackouts, and I still went to school, and I still thought I was on top of the world, you know. I still thought I was smarter than anybody, you know. I'm still going to make it somehow, some way I'm going to make it. And then I got pregnant, and I was in my first year of college, and I was really scared. I even wanted to have an abortion. That's how scared I was. And I was in L.A., on the bus, and I just found out I was pregnant at an abortion clinic. And I thought to myself, because in California you can have an abortion up to like 3 or 4 months. And I was almost there. And that's what my disease got me, where I would just drink and I wouldn't care, you know. And I remember there was a sticker under all the graffiti in LA. All the graffiti on that move on the tram. It just said, God is greater than any problem you have. And I just scoffed at that. Yeah, right. You know. But I had some money and I was gonna do it. But I don't know, I guess my Catholic upbringing said, no, you can't. You're gonna go to hell. You know. That's, you know, I didn't have a religion, so I was just like, you know, my dad was the only one that took me somewhere. So I was drinking a lot then. I was still drinking, still knowing that I was pregnant. My drinking got me so bad that I had a roommate, but she, I used to just control everyone without being too scared to tell that I drank too much being a roommate. She left. So I had to do something. And she stole like $300, my last $300. So I came back to Tucson, still partying. Still pregnant, and I remember my sister telling me, you know, I even try to go back to, that's my sick mind, I try to go back to LA to get on a bus while I was in labor, I was trying to get back to just escape, just to run away again. But I just only made it to Phoenix. My sisters still say that. Remember when Benita was trying to get away? She's over there all in labor. You know, it's a joke. I mean, it's funny now, but just think about that. God, that's how sick I was. That's how sick I was. And I still had a lot more to go. A lot more. And my sisters told me, how could you take this geek in front of us when you knew you were pregnant? I had no answer. I had no answer. So, with the help, I got a job, and I moved back here in Tucson, and I started working at the casino. That's a perfect place. My little baby's 2 months old. I live with my sister. And I was so conniving, and I thought, you know, I got to get out of here, you know. And I started making a lot of money. That was when they, you know, I was just making a lot of money with tips and stuff. So I moved out, and my other roommate, she was my best friend in high school. And she even left because I drank too much. She couldn't even take care of the baby. I would still drink even with Elizabeth, my daughter, you know. I almost, like, probably killed her one time because I even was breastfeeding her, you know. And I almost passed out on her. And luckily, my friend was there and rolled me over. And she says, I remember when the baby was like, you know, how sick can that be? What kind of person could do that to a baby, you know, feeding it alcohol? So I still didn't stop. I still did not stop. I still went on, and I still worked at the casino, which was even better for an alcoholic. I met someone there, and he loved me so much. He worshiped me. And I thought to myself, I can use this guy. I can use him. I can go move in with him, and he can take care of me and Elizabeth. And, you know, and for 11 years, I had that arrangement. I had another little girl, but she was, you know, with the grace of God, she was okay. But I still partied after she was born. And he never would tell me anything because he loved me so much. I didn't love myself. I hated myself. I hated myself. It took 5 years of that 11-year relationship to realize, oh, he's not going nowhere. 5 years. And my daughters, you know, there was always a party somewhere at my mom's sister's house. There's always a keg somewhere, you know. And I thought I was all like, no, I'm still involved with my kids. I still do what I'm supposed to do. And then I can party still. I can have the best of both worlds. I can control this. I am controlling this. And I'll even remember when my little girl was old enough to talk, she asked her daddy, when I was going for a beer at Circle K, you know, 12, 18 bag, and she told her dad, why does mama drink so much? You know, and he never had the guts to tell me that either. Until finally, after 11 years, he told me that. I mean, that's how much I controlled him. I controlled his mom and dad. We lived by them. And, you know, I just controlled everything. That was the play. That was my play. Finally, after 11 years, you know, I still kept my job at the casino, and I moved up because of the drinking. I got to socialize with everybody. Everybody loved Benita, you know. And when I broke up, that's how heartless I was. I even put flyers out saying divorce / birthday party. You know, and everybody even gave them to my you know, my significant other right there. Look, Benita's having a party, you know, and it's his divorce / birthday party, you know. I mean, how cruel, you know. And he just had to laugh it up because, you know, he was part of my play, you know. And I was like, I'll hurt you more than you hurt me. But that's how self-centered I was. That's how self-loathing and everything. You know, I controlled everything. So I thought. So I came out into the out that we lived on the reservation for 11 years, and then I came into town again, and I started being a poker dealer, and that was like the number one job for being an alcoholic. The more parties and bars you went to, the better off you could get up, you know. I could go to work drunk. I deal drunk. I went to my work drunk, you know. And everybody was just laughing, you know. And finally, my 11-year relationship got to me. I was so drunk, finally, I went to the other side of the casino where he was working. My lipstick was all smeared on my face, like down like a clown. And I went up to him, and he was working like where there's a lot of money. And I was telling him off, telling him, you know, how could you leave this? How could you leave this, you know? And how come you don't give me any money for the kids, you know? You know, they have it all on surveillance, you know? But I still, you know, I still thought I was the ruler. I was the queen of everything, you know. But I was brokenhearted. I was. You know, how dare somebody leave me, you know? How dare they, you know? What am I going to do with these kids crying? And my drinking escalated, you know. I found people to take care of my kids. I got my nephew to move in with me and his family so I could go party afterwards in the night, you know. And I got neighbors they became my best friend, and we would party with them. And all this time I thought I just did everything right. I just thought, oh yeah, I go to PTA meetings, but when the night's over, it's mine, you know. There I am, 12 o'clock, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm the best mother in the world. They don't even know anything about my drinking. Kids are a lot smarter than that. My neighbor that I was really good friends with, I was supposed to go to this bar with her. And it was a little juke joint, you know, Native American. And she got shot 5 times. And she was a grandmother, and she was like my kid's grandma. She even called, you know, she got shot. And I should have been with her, you know. That's God's grace. She got shot dead. And I was sad, you know, and my kids, you know, I was sad, but I still drank. Didn't matter, you know, life goes on. But I didn't know this is the thing. As I was still partying and going to work and come back home, and my kids would smell smoke and beer on me, and that was their comfort smell. That was their comfort smell, mama's home. And little did I know that out of this world that I thought that I created so better, like, you know, my kids are in Catholic school and they're in private school and, you know, this, and I can party here. Little did I know my children were holding each other in the night, crying, wondering when I'm going to get shot. When's mama going to get shot? Telling the oldest, telling the little, the youngest, it's going to be okay. She's going to come home. I was doing the exact same thing my mother did to me. And I told myself I never would be like that. I never would be that bad of a drunkard. I'd never keep my kids in a bar, you know. No, I brought the bar to them. But I still thought that I was a good parent. After that, I just stayed, you know, I just stayed in that world for a while, and I got another relationship, but I didn't let him in at all, you know. But I got pregnant, and this is my little boy, and I was going to have twins, twin boys. And by then, I was already doing cocaine. I was on coke. I love Blow. I love that movie Blow and Pulp Fiction. I can do any line. For my birthday, they got me the script to Pulp Fiction. Because they were tired of hearing me all rah, 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 doing the wrong lines. But, you know. And I thought I still was number one. I still was pretty cool. And I was, you know, I'll lick this one too. I'll lick this pregnancy, you know. And it took me a while to even tell people again. You know, it was just right back to the same cycle, the same insanity. And I finally went to my first little rehab, I called it. That was Grandma's house. And I made sure, even people would say, oh, you got to go back to rehab. I know. You know, and I start taking care of myself for the babies. But I still, you know, I'll never forget. I was still friends with my cocaine dealer. You know, everything. You know, I still had those people around me. You know, I still had that world. Just waiting. Just like it is, cunning, patient, waiting for you, you know. And I thought I took care of myself. But I was over there at my sonogram. I wasn't due for a sonogram, and the baby's heart stopped, one of them. And I was rushed to the hospital, and I had to have a cesarean because one of my little boys were dead already. And after all this time, I thought, wow, you know, if I should have just stopped drinking that first time I found out I was pregnant. You know, things just went racing in my mind. I took care of myself this time. You know, that was just a big lie. That was just a big lie. So I have one alive and one dead. And my family, they're like strong Native people. Of course, my sisters told me, you just got to buckle up. You got a baby here. You can't be sad about the other one. You got to just keep going on. Go, you know. And like a good, you know, good person, I just said, okay, I can handle this. I can handle this. You know, I can do it. So little did I know I was dying inside more and more, not just for alcoholism, but my heart was dying, you know. If you ever had a child that was gone, it takes a part of you. It takes a lot of you. And they even told me that this could happen. I even told them about drinking before the beginning. They said this could have happened even in a normal pregnancy. And sure enough, later on, my drug dealer gave me some coke, you know, to make me feel better after I got out of the hospital. I was like, oh, there it is, you know, there it is. And I used to always say, I'm not any, her, his wife was pregnant the same time I was, and she would do lines in front of me. And I would tell myself, damn, I'm not that bad. At least I'm not that bad. Yeah, I just drink. I don't do lines like that. Why I'm pregnant, you know. But, you know, her baby came out healthy, and she made sure to tell me that, you know. But that's just that disease, like I said. And I found it harder to go to the cemetery and to the funerals and stuff like that. That's when I start binging. One time I went to my aunt's funeral, and I left for 3 days. Nobody seen me. And the baby, I still had my baby. He was just little. He was just baby, just like 4 months. And I still just left him. And I didn't know why. I was going crazy in my mind. I was going crazy. I couldn't handle it. I really couldn't. But I wasn't going to tell nobody because I survived a lot of things. I could do this. I could beat this. So I found myself at Keno Hospital trying to admit myself into the psychiatric ward. And I found out really fast why you sit with your back on the wall in the sanitarium. I found out a lot of things, you know. But I wasn't crazy like that either. What's wrong with me? I must be crazy. They evaluated me and I was fine. They told me you're okay. And my friend was telling me, just tell me you want to kill yourself. What? I don't want to kill myself, you know. I don't want to kill myself, but I was killing myself. Alcoholism had me so wrapped up and so that I didn't even know how to even feel. I was so numb. Even when I wouldn't drink, I was just waiting right there. But I still kept going, and I got my own apartment, and I took the kids with me, and I started letting the girls watch the baby, and I would go to work. But I would come home with a six-pack, you know, after the bars closed. But they wouldn't know. They were asleep. What would they know? And my daughters were growing up then. But then I remember when they were going to go to school, and I had this fear of being with my little baby alone because I had all this liquor hidden. I had all these beers made sure in my restroom, in my walk-in closet, you know, where just to go. And I felt fear for the first time of not knowing who I was, not knowing that my kid, my little baby, depends on me, and I might not be here after that third drink. I might be, who knows? That still didn't stop me. That still didn't stop me. And by the grace of God, I got a DUI. And I remember when they stopped me. And I still got to hide that somehow. I got the money from my drug dealer to pay for the fines and stuff, you know. And nobody knew about it, but it still was declining, and I still didn't see it. And then finally, I remember when I got that DUI, and then I started really drinking, and I finally tried again to go to St. Mary's. I remember being buzzed and giving them my keys, and I stayed in there for, like, I don't know, about 3 hours till they evaluated me again, sanitariums, again, trying to find that insanity, what's going on. They gave me my keys, and they told me I was fine. Evaluation, I still didn't hear about AA or nothing. But my family heard about it, and my family told me, you better straighten up or else we're taking all the kids away, and that's it, you know. And I said, I'll find a way to lick this softer way. So I went to where they told me to go to an outpatient. I went, and of course, I was the top student there. Yeah, I was the top student. My whatever she was, like, counselor, she was, like, my best friend already, you know. I was cunning, you know, and she gave me the award. My kids were there, and I was just like, oh, I got this. She doesn't even know I'm going to, like, the bar after this, you know. She doesn't even know I'm going to the Mustang, you know, go karaoke, you know. And that's how bad the disease is, because I aced that outpatient treatment. I aced it. And that night that I aced it, I went back to the res looking for someone to party with, because that's the thing. I was so smart that the bar never closed for me. I knew where the bootleggers were. I knew where the drugs was. It was 24/7 for me. You know, I knew everything, supposedly. And my nephew, he's my niece's father, the father of her kids, he just got out of rehab. He just got out of rehab. And I, with my fresh certificate of outpatient care, there we were. There we were on the res, drinking in the pickup truck, all right, singing, showing them my, you know, voice. And we hope and party for like 2 days. And then we're running out. And I remember being at that bar, little dive, and telling him, here we are again, in trouble. I've been home for 2 days, you two, 3 days, I think. How do we do this, Will? Why do we get like this? Why? And I'll never forget him taking that drink and saying, Benita, if I had the answer, I'd tell you. And we're running out of money, like I said. It was, daybreak was coming. And I called in again, 15 years of a poker dealer, called in. I knew I was on my last legs of my, I had a nice car. And next thing you know, I don't even remember turning around because I was so tired of 2 days of cocaine. And he said, I'm going to get out here and I'm going to go walk to my uncle's house. I told him, I didn't even say bye. I was just like tired because we got a driver for us. And they're like, if he passes out, we can't go drink at the bar. So that's when he took off. And I didn't know that was the last time I'd see my nephew. I didn't know that not even a couple hours after that, they would beat him to death. Because they said he was stealing their cocaine somewhere on the reservation. Later on, somebody found me, and I called work, all buzz. I couldn't face my family. No way, not this time. My life was really unmanageable this time. You did it, Benita. You hit the jackpot now. That was it. That was it. I was like, I'm dead. That's it. There's no way I can go see my niece, look at her and her little three kids, and tell her I was partying with him, you know? That guilt, that shame, you know? We both just got out of treatment. Both of us. He was in a treatment for 3 months. That guilt consumed me. That guilt almost killed me. I just decided I'm going to drink myself to death now. That's it. I should have died. I should have died too. How can I even look at my family? I couldn't. I was gone. I left my baby. My baby was only like 9 months. I left him. Didn't tell nobody where I went, what I did. Everything illegal. I made all kinds of money. Still, I was dying inside. I was waiting for that I was waiting for me, for my body to just say, that's it. And that didn't happen fast enough because I was about 30 more days. That still didn't help. So I decided I was going to end my life with the car. I had my car. I was driving down this road where all, like a lot of people on the reservation die because there's a lot of trees and stuff. And I let go of the wheel. I let go, and I spun, and I was driving fast. I spun, and I said, this is it, this is it. All right, finally I'm done. That car ended up on the other side of the road as if I just parked it. I was like, I can't even do this shit right, you know, man. I'm supposed to be in control of this world. You know, I tell myself when I'm going to die. I remember saying that to Dr. Nye, telling him, that's it. She's all, can't you see? Creator was all over you. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it. So I admitted myself to rehab. I admitted myself. And for the first time, I put out all that stuff, all that garbage, all that guilt of molestation, all my survival, everything. I thought I was supposed to have a spiritual awakening when I would get up. I was like, oh, this is the day that the ground opens up and everybody, all the angels fly out, you know? And I kept going to meetings with my rehab, and I was like, I never knew that the spiritual part was just going and being there, just being present. That could be your spiritual awakening, just showing up, something telling you, something telling me that I am worth living. Something, but I don't know what it was, because I thought God damned me the minute that I got molested. I thought God damned me the minute that he gave me a mother like that. I thought God damned me, you know, drinking and all that. I thought, you know, it was everybody else's fault. It was God's fault. It was my mom's fault. It was, you know, my sister's fault. Never being there. My brother's fault, you know. I thought it was everybody's fault. Not me. I was an angel. I was a special one, remember? It snowed when I was born. You know. I was just so deluded. Just so deluded. And I remember getting out of rehab, and I was so scared because it was Halloween. And they told me that to be at a success rate, about 70%, if you can find a meeting the first night you get out. I'm like, on Halloween? I don't think so, you know. And I went back to Possible because my sister had taken care of my baby when I was in rehab. And they let me go for the first time by myself. I can go with the stroller and my little boy. You know, nobody wanted to take care of me anymore. They're like, you went, you're cured. And I was like, how could I be, that was God working. How could I be somewhere with no transportation, Halloween night, and no way to get to a meeting? My sisters and them were tired of taking care of my kids, tired of taking care of me. You know, they're not going to take me downtown or somewhere to a meeting. And I'm strolling down with my little boy. And next, you know, I hear this cackling of women. And I went straight over there because I just knew that ring, that sarcasm. And it was a women's shelter. It was a women's rehab shelter. And I was talking to them, and I told them, I just got out. And they're like, oh, really? And they're like, wow. I said, but they told me to go to a meeting. They're like, we're going to have a meeting in an hour. Oh, just come back. I was like, oh, my God, you know. And there's my little baby in me doing the serenity prayer with everybody. I mean, that is God's will, not mine. I found something. I found people that knew, you know, what it was like, what this misery is, you know, and that there was a solution. I found something. I didn't know what it was yet. I really didn't. Even out of rehab, I did not know God's way. I still went to meetings, but I was just still, like, not into this. I did the steps, but I was like, I need to get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor, and I was so happy because this guy lady got 15 years, and I was like, that's my sponsor. That's her. She knows her stuff. And I was just like, I just couldn't wait for her to meet up with me. And she forgot about me. We're supposed to be at a restaurant and meet there, and she did something to her tile or wood or something, and I was so mad and resentful. I'm serious. That's how an alcoholic I was. I kept that resentment for 2 years. And I used to go to meeting. I was waiting for her to apologize, to at least just say, I'm sorry I didn't make it. She didn't. She brought a dog. She used to bring a dog to her meeting. And the dog would look at me, and then I was just waiting for that apology. I think that was just what take me to that meeting too, you know. And that dog would always put its head on my lap, and I looked at it, and I'm like, I'm okay. And then I finally started saying in my alcoholic mind, this dog is my sponsor more than that lady. And I held that resentment, and I didn't get another sponsor due to that resentment, but I still went to meetings. I still showed up. I showed up. I suited up, and I showed up. And that still got me sober for 2 more years of still not even going through the steps with the person. And I finally realized, you know what, this is going to work. It's like 5 years in the 11-year relationship. This is going to work. You know, just that spirituality alone in AA, that fellowship, those people hearing me cry about what I did. And they didn't look at me like my sisters and say, what the heck's wrong with you, you know? God, what are we going to do with you? They didn't. The fellowship accepted me. They accepted me. And I had to learn to accept myself, to find a place with my higher power, and to let that guilt go. But I still needed a sponsor. I needed somebody to show me that. I needed somebody. I didn't know that. I was doing good for 2 years. But I guess, like God's will, you know, God's grace, it was time for me to get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor. And, oh, after doing that fourth step, my heart just, like, filled with so much that words are just uncanny. They are just, you know the feeling. That feeling's in this room right now. That feeling. There's no words. So I did my steps with my sponsor. And I was so happy. I was so happy. And like it says, you got to give it away. You do got to give it away. Because this is so special. Why wasn't I dead and not my other? Why? That's not my doing. That's God's. You know, that's not what he wants in my plan. He wants me to happy, be happy, joyous, and free. Free of those bondages of self, self-centered and selfless. He wants me to be happy. For once in your life, Anita, be happy. Take it easy. Take it easy. One step, just one step. Maybe two. Maybe one moment. Maybe even one breath. Take it easy. Now, you know, I'm 6 years later, and I stand before you. And, you know, I don't have a bank account that has trillions. You know, my last name's not Obama or Ronstadt or anyone else, you know. But God gave me something to give to you, to this fellowship, because you gave me something. And at Little House, we have this little plaque. It says, why God did not give to the famous or to the gifted. He gave it to the drunkard. And I'll tell you today, I'm so happy to be one of those drunks. Thank you.
Thank you, Belinda, for your wonderful story. Our next speaker is also from Tucson. Please help me welcome Fernando.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Fernando. I'm an alcoholic. The truth is, I'm really a drunk. But alcoholic sounds so much nicer. It's got a nice little ring to it. Oh, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a junkie and I'm a drunk. And I'm a grateful one today. It's always an honor to share what has been given freely to me with you folks. You know, I want to say thanks to Ray. When he asked me to speak here, I told him 20 years ago at this event I met my wife. So what an honor and a blessing that was for me to have the opportunity to come share what my life was like 20 years after that insanity 20 years ago. I was born here in Tucson. Probably not far from where Benita was born. I grew up in your traditional drunken, junkie, alcoholic home. Dad got drunk, dad came home, dad beat the crap out of mom. You tried to stay out of his way. And then in the morning you woke up and everything was wonderful. I was taught to lie at a very early age. Pretend everything is great when you walk out of the house. What happens inside these walls goes nowhere. So for me, the facade was very easy to put on. I was the youngest of a family of, I have seven brothers and sisters, so I was the youngest of eight. I had my first drink at seven at my oldest brother's wedding. Had my first drunk at that time also. Woke up under the table after slamming all the champagne glasses that were laying around after the toasts were all done. Sick as a dog and swore I would never drink again. And it's easy to do when you're that age, to swear it off for a long time. Because I did. I swore it off for a long time. It was 4 or 5 years before I drank again. Before I forgot how much pain I was in that night when I was sick. When I was, I started to drink and do drugs regularly at the age of 11. By the age of 12, I was dealing dope in elementary school, junior high. My oldest brother, whose wedding I got drunk at, by the time I got to high school, was a high school teacher. Man, talk about a nice perk, knowing that your older brother still smokes pot and still drinks, and he's your teacher. I mean, that is a great gift. Creator was taking care of me way back then, even. And so he introduced me to all the teachers that did drugs in the high school and drank. And so I made sure my schedule was full of their classes, made school much easier. But I was a troubled youth, I guess, is an easy way to say it. I got drunk regularly, almost daily. I did drugs daily. But my life, you know, was not out of control. And the cool part about normal, the thing I love about that word normal, is it's wherever I am. So my life was absolutely normal with the people I hung out with. There was nothing abnormal about me. I hung out with dopers and drunks, and we all were pretty normal in our little group. So I took all these classes with all these teachers. I used to sell dope to some of the teachers, and I was socially promoted out of high school, which basically means I knew too much, and they wanted me out really bad. So I graduated, and now see, this is the kind of drunk I was. I graduated at the bottom of my class and was so proud of how stupid I was. See? That's a good drunk right there, a good junkie right there. It was like 452 graduates my senior year, and I was like 442, and I'm like, yeah, one of the dumbest people graduate, you know. Wow. So I got out of high school, and my disease progressed, needless to say. After high school, I went to college, and for some reason, if you don't know the teachers that do drugs, and you go back to school and you're supposed to actually do the work, it's a lot harder. So I went to college and I flunked out, and I was not a very nice person. I was actually pretty mean. I grew up around a lot of motorcycle riders, bikers, and like for my 11th birthday, right? No, my 12th birthday, they made me drink 12 glasses of beer. And then they threw me on the back of a Harley and proceeded to try to throw me off all around town for the next couple of hours as I was drunk as a skunk hanging on, you know. And I thought, how cool am I, you know, hanging out with all these bikers as they're laughing their butts off at me as I'm being towed, throwing up all over myself and thinking, "Wee!" You know, this is the life. So after I got out of high school and tried college and flunked out of that, I just couldn't find my niche. You know, I couldn't find that spot where I belonged. Other than, you know, when she talked about the Mustang, I was like, wow. It wasn't called the Mustang back then, but it was called, I can't remember what it was called, Reba's, I don't know. But anyways, I used to go there a lot. And the reason I went there, okay, now, don't take any offense to this, but it was a very, it wasn't a very high-scale bar. So I would go to bars where I would stand out, and I would look good. And my sponsor told me, he goes, "You are so stupid. That's why everybody else was there too." Never dawned on me. So I would go to all these low these dives and drink because I thought I was above, and it was one of the few places where I felt superior to the people I was hanging out with. And I continued this lifestyle for a long time. I remember the kind of person I was. If you remember when John Lennon died, they had a huge event at Reed Park, and I was lit up. And I was very loud, very obnoxious, and the crowd was turning on me. You know, there was going to be another murder. It was just a little bit west of Times Square in Tucson. And what I said was, which I thought was hilarious, but apparently people that are in tears and are very sensitive didn't think it was so funny. I told my friend, "Hold my beer. I got to go to the John." "Oh, you get it? I got to go to the John." It was John Lennon's memorial. Man, the crowd just roar, and I'm like, okay, it's time to go. I took pride in hurting people because I felt so shitty about me. And that's the only way I felt better, is if I could make you hurt, I would feel better. And I didn't care if that meant getting my rear end beat. I didn't care if that meant belittling you. I didn't care what it meant, as long as I felt like I was something. Because inside, I was nothing. When you're dying on the inside and you're looking for a reason to live, and your only option is booze and dope, it's just a horrible cycle. A horrible cycle. So that's the kind of drunk I was. I would hurt people, and I hated the phone call the morning after, where they're telling me what I did, and I'm like, "Oh, I did that, you know, and you don't want to show your Facebook, you know, just like I did when I was 7. That memory fades so fast. There used to be a guy at the Little House who always said, "My forgetter forgets real well." As a drunk, my forgetter forgot real well. So I was running drugs with outlaw bikers by the time I was in my early 20s, and running mass quantities of drugs up and out from Nogales to Tucson and then out of Tucson. And I was making huge money, right? I had more money than I knew what to do with, and And that's supposed to be the solution. If you're drunk and you're poor and you grew up very poor, your solution is always money, more money. If you have enough money, you're going to be happy. Well, I had a ton of money, and I couldn't find any joy. Only joy I found was hurting people and saying horrible things to people so that I could feel better. So, you know, by the time I was in my early 20s, I was doing enough cocaine to kill a horse, and I couldn't stop. And I couldn't stop. And I worked at that big missile factory south of Tucson, and it's a great place to work if you're a drug dealer, because there is so many people there that did drugs back in this day, in those days. And so I made more money with my side job there than I did at my actual job. And I had a great boss who who I would call, I worked graveyard shift, who I would call at 10 o'clock at night and say, I'm too drunk to come in. And he would say, you get your fat butt over there, I'll decide if you're too drunk. And he'd come out in a golf cart, throw me in this golf cart and drive me into this plant, right? Go in by the guard shack, I'll go find a dark corner and hide till everybody leaves. I would sleep all night on your dime. You were paying for my wonderful salary. And that was truly, I was very qualified for that job when it came to passing out and sleeping. I was very well qualified for that job, so I did very well at sleeping. But it got to the point where I was doing so much and drinking so much that I couldn't get through a shift. I did 4 o'clock in the morning, and my hands are like this. I'm 24 years old, and that's how I'm living. At 24, where I can't, I'm trying to hold a cup of coffee, and I'm like, this is great. I'm thinking, what disease do I have? I've got a disease, because it's not my drinking. That's not my problem. It's not my drug. It's I got something going on where it's, you know, and I couldn't stop. So what does a brilliant alcoholic do? We have 200 proof ethyl alcohol that we clean parts with that we're putting together. You see, light bulb, ding! Right? So I'll get a can of Sprite, I'll pour some out, and I'll pour some of that 200 proof ethyl alcohol in there, and my shakes would go away. So I found the cure to my disease. It was more, and it worked. It kept me so wonderfully drunk. And then, of course, if you work graveyard, who knows what time happy hour is? 7 a.m., happy hour for the graveyard shift. So my next stop was the Mustang. Well, I would have my nice breakfast with beer. And so that was my life, 24-7. I'm riding a Harley, drunk as a skunk, buying a 12-pack as I'm pulling into my neighborhood, putting 6 in the fridge and 6 by my bed. Drink until I pass out, choking 1 when I wake up. That was my life, 7 days a week, 24 years old. I met a woman. I didn't talk about women because for some reason, women don't like men who are really, really mean. I don't understand why. I mean, inside, way down in there, there was a really nice guy. But I was a horrible person. So this gal I met, I couldn't drive her away. She would not leave. And I would say horrible things to her, and she would stay. And I couldn't understand why. If you hate yourself enough, relationships aren't an option. They're just not an option. Because if you can't stand yourself, nobody else is going to want to be around you. You know, when Benita was talking about suicide, at the end of my drinking, I was driving up and down Mount Lemmon. And before they redid the road, there was a gap on Windy Point between the edge of the mountain and the guardrail. And I'm on my motorcycle, and I was doing this 2 or 3 times a week, and I'm going off the bike on Windy Point. And I couldn't go straight. And when she said, you know, I can't even kill myself, what kind of man are you? You can't even take your own life. So this gal that wouldn't go away, I was 20, 25 at this point. I was drinking nonstop. I was doing drugs nonstop. And we're at dinner at the Silver Saddle, right? And if you've ever been to the Silver Saddle, there's seats up high around the edges, and then there's seats on the bottom. Well, we're in the bottom, and I'm dying. I have a hole through my nose from cocaine abuse. I have blood coming out of every orifice of my body. I look about the same color as this book, and I'm swollen. My face was shaped kind of like one of these balls here. I mean, I was just like a big old cherry tomato on my shoulders. But there was nothing wrong. Everything was okay. And she looked at me and she says, "You're going to kill yourself. Don't you see what you're doing to yourself?" And I don't know what happened. I would love to say that I had epiphany, but what happened was I had a breakdown. I started to cry, right? And if you hung out with the people I hung out with, you don't cry. Because those people see you cry and they make you the victim when you show weakness to these people. You can't show weakness. So here I am in this restaurant and I can't stop crying. And people are looking at me like, what is this big old cherry tomato looking fool crying in the middle of the restaurant? But I couldn't stop. But what she said rung a bell. I was on my last legs at that missile factory. And you know, the kind of person I was, here I am. I have this hole from cocaine abuse and profuse bleeding occasionally, like once a day. And I'm riding this bike, man, and you pull up to a stoplight, right, and I'm covered in blood, and you look at the people next to you, and you scream at them, "What are you looking at?" It is amazing how straight they will look and hold their steering wheel. They won't even turn their head sideways. They're like, "Don't look over. There's a psychopath next to me." But that's how I lived at the end of my drinking. I went to my work, and I told them that something was wrong, and they told me that I had to go to treatment. No, that's not my problem. I don't need treatment. And they said I have one choice: quit my job or go to treatment. Those were my options. I had to make one or the other. And so I chose treatment because I didn't want to lose my job. And so I went to treatment, you know, planned my escape every night. You know, it's not even a locked facility, but I'm going to escape. You know, I became Steve McQueen, and I am going to break out of this joint. And, you know, the funny part is I would go lay down. Okay, at 3 o'clock, I'm going to put all my stuff in my suitcase, which was my pillowcase, doubled as my pillowcase. So I'm thinking, at 3 o'clock, I'll pack all my stuff, and I'll make the dash for freedom. Right? I'm not right here in Tucson. It's not locked. They don't care if I stay or not. But I'd pass out, or I'd fall asleep. This was truly falling asleep. I would fall asleep, and I'd wake up to the banging at the door. "Get up, it's 7 o'clock. I'm like, "Oh, shoot, I missed my breakout time. My window's closed." I did treatment. I did 30 days of treatment with absolutely no intention of staying sober, absolutely no intention of looking into recovery, absolutely no intention of any of this mumbo-jumbo that these people were talking to me for the last 30 days. The most honest statement I made while I was in treatment was when they asked me, "What have you been successful at?" And I'm in this little group with four or five other people. And I looked at them and I said, "Failure. That's what I've been most successful at. Anything good I had going on in my life, I sabotaged. If it was a relationship..." You know, I dated the girl at that missile factory that everybody wanted to date. And I asked her to a Christmas party, and she said yes. And everybody's like, "Why is she going with this guy? It's a beautiful white gal and this big Indian guy." But see, my downfall was, I'll have one beer at the Christmas party. I've never been real successful at one beer. So obviously I failed again, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, we're in the middle of the road right out here. Broadway or Congress and Granada, and I'm doing donuts. She's like, "Will you please take me home?" Well, needless to say, but that was what I did. I sabotaged everything in my life. My graduation at treatment, I asked this native kid from cells, from Topawa, to speak at my ceremony. And we're sitting there. This was west of town, a very nice treatment facility that I really was way above my class of people. I mean, you got movie stars in there and all these people that have lots and lots of money, and then you got a couple of Indians running around. We weren't the token Indians either. There was. But, you know, I asked this kid to speak at my thing, and it's a beautiful summer night, and he elbows me and he goes, "Look up in the trees." And I look up in the tree, and there's this huge owl in the palm tree. And I'm like, wow. I go, and I asked him, what does the owl mean to your people? And he says, well, the owl's the messenger of death. And I'm like, oh, not what you want to hear at your graduation ceremony from treatment, right? But he goes, no, that's good. And I'm like, how can that be good? And he says, well, the old you's died, and you get to start all over again. And I started to cry. Wow, what a gift. The old, that monster was slayed. Now, I graduated from treatment, and you know they tell you go 90 meetings in 90 days. Not this rebel. 89 days. Not going to conform to the ways of the white people. And of course, if you're a good Southside Indian, where do you go to meetings? As far away as possible. So I am at Sabino and Sunrise with all these rich people. See, I don't fit in. I don't fit in. All these people with driving Jaguars and Lexuses, and here I come in my old Harley making lots of noise. And what did they tell me? Keep coming back. No, I don't want to come back. I don't want to be here. Keep coming back. So I had no intentions of staying sober. I had no intentions of practicing any of these principles because they made no sense to me. And I was living in fear still. I was still dealing dope. I was still hanging out with the same lunatics, but I wasn't drinking. And I wasn't using. And that's the only thing I did right. Didn't drink, and I didn't use. And so 1 year to the day, this wonderful woman that would never leave me while I was using, she left me sober, right? So I have my loaded gun, because that's what men do when they're angry at their women who have just dumped them, is they get a loaded gun and they plan on murdering them, and then they're going to kill themselves. Of course, I couldn't kill myself in my motorcycle, but I think sober I can do this. One too many AA meetings. I'm warning you right now, if you're new, you're going to hit that one too many and you're in trouble. You're lost. You're going to be in recovery for the rest of your life, God willing. So my thought was, I'm going to go kill this gal, and then I'm going to kill her boyfriend, and then I'm going to kill me, right? But first, I'm going to go to a meeting. Never conducive for murder. So I go to the little house, right? And I sit in the, and I'm sitting in this meeting, and the worst part was, they were honest. And one of the guys that I had grown to like says to me, shut up, get in your truck, and go kill her. And I'm like, what? What kind of advice is this for people in recovery? And he looks at me, or sit down, shut up, and listen. Wow. No one had ever told me that. So I sat down. I didn't say a word, and I listened. And what these people told me was the truth is I never gave recovery a chance. How could I ever benefit from recovery if it was going to be my way? So I listened to these people go on for an hour, and then they invited me for coffee. Not a lot of people I really wanted to hang out with, but I went. And here's the funny part. This was my first time hanging out with AA people after a meeting. We went to a mountain, and they got a telescope out, and they were looking at stars, and I'm like, wow, this is recovery? I'll be looking at stars all night. Never once did I look at that they were trying to help me. Never once did I look at what these people were doing for me. All I looked at is, this is not cool. This is not for me. So at 1 o'clock, because back then, booze was only sold till 1, they kept me out till 1. 1 o'clock, I go to the bar where my girlfriend's drinking at, and it's obviously dead. It's about 1:30. So I'm driving to the after party, because I'm still planning, I'm still loosely planning this murder-suicide thing. And I pull up to the stoplight on Speedway and Stone. And my best friend, my very best friend that I drank and did drugs with throughout high school, throughout many years after high school, is in the car next to me. And I tell him, pull over. So we go to the Circle K. I said, these people in AA are full of crap. They don't know what they're talking about. He's got a 12-pack of beer behind him and the seat behind him. And I'm like, yes, yes, finally. This guy is drunk. And he looks at me and he says, you don't want to drink, man. Can't you see what you got? Go home and go to bed. And I tore into him, cursed him up one side and down the other, got in my truck, slammed the door, all the way home, cursing him. And I went home and I went to bed. And I woke up and I said, somebody is taking care of me. And it sure ain't Fernando. because Fernando was planning on a murder. And Fernando's not only is he sober, but his best friend drunk told him to go home and go to bed that I had something. And I didn't even know what I had. The kicker for me, and that was the day I surrendered. That was the morning I got on my knees and I said, God, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you are. But please, I can't do this. And I went to this guy's house a week later in his living room with tears in my eyes. I said, dude, I think you saved my life. And he looks at me and goes, really? Well, what did I say? How can I fight with God when he's doing these miracles in my life? Because that's who my battle was with. It wasn't with my disease anymore. It was with my concept of God. And my concept of God was my religion as a child, and I was going to hell. That was never in question. So the cool part about surrendering was it allows the miracles to happen. Because I met my sponsor 3 or 4 days after that happened. And I'm at a meeting, and I says, you know, here's this old guy that everybody's looking, talking to, and he's really, and I want some advice. And he says, you need a sponsor. Come. I said, no, I don't need a sponsor. Just need a little advice. Just come on, give me some wisdom of the old guy. And here's my address. Be at my house at noon. All right, whatever. Put the number in my pocket and went on my way. And at 11:55 the next day, I'm pulling into this driveway like, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? Why am I here? And of course, his name was Boston Tom, and he was a great old dude, and he was very, very well respected in the community of in Tucson and recovery. He passed away many years ago, but he talked to me about the Boston Bruins, about the Red Sox, the Patriots. Never talked to me about alcoholism or my problem. And what he told me was that this is a way of life. It's a design for living. It says that in the big book. This is a design for living. And he taught me how to live. This old man breathed life into these dead lungs. I don't even know if he knew my name, because he always called me kid. Hey, kid. Hey, kid. Can you take me to the school meeting tonight, kid? All right, I'll come. And every day, and he was not a very nice man. And that's probably why God put me with him. Like, I would be called on at a meeting, and I'd introduce myself. I'm Fernando, I'm an alcoholic. And he would yell from across the room, and that's all you know, so sit down, shut up, and listen. So I planned this man's murder almost every time we went to a meeting, because nobody humiliates me in front of a crowd like that, except him, every time we're together. I love this old man. I remember I heard something really snappy at a meeting, and I learned right away snappy things and him don't go well together. But I walked in and sitting in his apartment. I said, well, I work a good program, don't I? This old guy got up, walked across his apartment, and kicks me. And I'm like, what? And he says, this isn't a job. This isn't something you punch in at 8 o'clock in the morning and you punch out at 5 and you can be a jerk the rest of the day. This is a way of life. And if you don't make it a way of life, you'll never find anything good in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, oh. So I learned a couple things. Snappy things don't go well with him. Those cute little statements I got to be careful with him. But what I really learned was that I had to make a decision in my life. What do I want? Do I want happy, joy, and free? Do I want that insanity? And it truly was a perplexing question. When I got to my third step, I was so afraid that God would say no. Sorry, buddy. You're not welcome. You hurt way too many people. You did too many horrible things. You are not welcome. And it was so funny because I'm going on and on about this God thing, and he looks up at me, right? And he says, I am so effing sick of what you think. And he grabbed me by my hand and he pulled me down to my knees and he said, let's pray. And I'm like, no, the lightning bolts are going to be coming soon. And in the middle of a park, I'm not real big on public prayer. In the middle of a park, he pulls me down on my knees and we say the third step prayer. And he says, son, the jump you got to make ain't nearly as big as you think it is. Stop thinking, start doing. He reminded me, faith without works is dead. You can't do this thinking. He says, you can sit on your ass till you're blue in the face thinking about changing your life, and your life will never change. You got to get up and do it. we went through the steps, and one day it was Christmas, and I went to pick him up for the Alcathon on Christmas Day, and I banged on his door at his apartment, no answer, bang again, no answer, bang again, and I hear this mumbling, and I'm like, what? So I walk in, and he can't get up. He's on the toilet. And so I help him up, and I clean him up, and I get him dressed, and we took him to the VA hospital, and he was terminally ill with cancer. I was about 3 years sober. I wasn't real hip on doing this whole thing again with another sponsor. And I kept telling him, you can't die, you SOB. You're not done with me yet. And he would laugh at me and say, I don't have a say. You know, it's not like I have a choice in this matter. Even in death, this dude was incredible. Unbelievable that the dignity that he had through this last phase of his life. And he told me something that I'll always cherish. And he says, kid, God will give you enough time to tie up all your loose ends. He said, so always have a loose end. And I thought about that, and I'm like, wow, yeah, always have a loose end, so I'm guaranteed another day. I've got tons of loose ends still, and I'm 23 years in recovery now. And the last thing with him was he told me that he had to go home and tie up his loose ends in Boston. And I wheeled him, took him to the airport. And back then you could go to the gates with the people that were flying out. And as I wheeled him out in the wheelchair, he's going down that tarmac and he yells, hey kid, I love you. That's the first time I ever believed that anybody could love this unlovable person. And he didn't give a shit how much money I had. He didn't care where I came from. All he cared was that I wanted to change my life. And he helped me. And he got to go home and tap his loose ends. And he prepared me for a life in recovery. He prepared me to live, not just exist. You know, I found another sponsor, and I've worked with several sponsors, and I had horrible relationships in recovery, and I had great relationships in recovery. And I remember, some of you might remember Jumpsuit Frank. He was an old guy in Tucson, and I was going off about my horrible relationships in recovery, and he says to me, and he had two hearing aids, so he always screamed, right, because he can't hear. He goes, Fernando, the next time you see that girl, and she's got that twinkle in your eye, and you got that twinkle in your eye, he says, do me a favor. And I'm thinking, here it is, man, the wisdom of the old guy. What is it? What is it? He goes, turn around and run for your life, because you suck when it comes to picking out women. And then my sponsor would always tell me, well, you know, water seeks its own level. That's a horrible statement to say in relationships when every relationship you've had has been horrible. Water seeks it. What does that mean? Twenty years ago, I met my wife here. We came to the Yes Convention. I was still riding motorcycles with a bunch of guys in the program. And we came here. And God is amazing. If you have a chance to stay sober and live this life, God is so amazing. And he's so funny. He's got a great sense of humor. But I come here, and we hang out. We go to the dance, and we take off for a ride. It's about 11:30 at night. We take off for a long ride. We end up at Denny's on St. Mary's and I-10. Got to be 40 cop cars around Denny's. What is going on? So we walk into Denny's. The cop's walking right behind us. I'm like, we didn't do anything wrong. Because, of course, as an addict, you know, dope dealer, oh no, because, you know, I'm caught. The truth was, God gave me golden lips, and I knew just where to place them on that cop's ass when they pulled me over, so I didn't go to jail. That's the truth about my recovery, because I got pulled over so many times in where I should have been incarcerated for long periods of time, and I never did. But 20 years ago, this cop follows us in, and he talks to the manager, and all of a sudden, they're pulling blinds, closing doors, nobody's coming in, the helicopter's hovering in the parking lot, there's an escaped convict out in the parking lot. What? No one can leave. So God knew that I had finally surrendered that I was going to be okay living single the rest of my life. And then God says, no, you're not. But he locks me into Denny's all night. The main speaker's with a bunch of people in the committee. And me and my buddies, we're singing theme song from Gilligan's Island, the Brady Bunch. We're having so much fun. And my buddy sang in a band. He jumps up on the table, and he's singing Johnny B. Goode, and then he screams, "What are they going to do? Throw me out?" Well, no one could leave. So my wife, my future wife, and another gal come over and say, "Can we join you guys? You guys are having fun. They all want to go to sleep." So we sat there and drank coffee, and that was the night I was introduced to the woman who would become my wife years down the road. So God has an incredible plan for all of us if we stick around long enough to let it be enacted. My oldest daughter, I'll end with this. My oldest daughter, we lost a child not long after we got married, and I agree with what Benita said because it was a tremendously traumatic time in my life because I was questioning God, I was blaming her, blaming God, blaming me, blaming everybody until I finally come to grips with it was just the way it was intended to be, and I there was nothing I could do about it. So my daughter, my oldest daughter, is born on August 24th, 1999. I had my last drink on August 24th, 1987. And it was so funny because in the delivery room, right, I'm bawling. See, you know, here's the funny part, man. I did not cry. I did not shed a tear from the time I was about 9. I mean, I was beat to a pulp and I refused to let people know how much it hurt me. So from the time I was 9 till that day that I fell apart in that restaurant, I did not shed a tear. Grandmother's funeral, I don't care. You know, best friend's funeral, brother's, I don't care. But after I got sober, man, I can't turn these stinking things off. So here I am, bawling my eyes out, videotaping my daughter's birth, and my wife looks at the nurse, she goes, "And it's his birthday, too." And the nurse is like, "No way, how old are you?" I says, "I'm 12. And they're like, "12? So my daughter was born, and what, there's God again, you know? Once again, my daughter was born on the day I cleaned up. What more could a man ask, a human ask for from God than a beautiful child on the day that I changed my life? That my life changed. I should say I changed my life. That my life changed. I didn't change it. God is awesome. I have another beautiful little girl. And, like, you know, I'm in so much trouble because they truly are beautiful little girls down the road. I got to buy a gun. And I haven't owned a gun since I quit drinking. But God has been incredible. And recovery truly for me is about God. It truly is. You know, I was taught very young in recovery that there's an old cowboy used to say, God, AA, and Fernando, and in that order. And that's always been my premise. When I married my wife, we made the commitment to each other that if our recovery became challenged in our marriage, we had the right to walk away. Because I know what kind of father I'd be as a drunk and as a junkie. And she knows what kind of mother she would be as an alcoholic. So I know that the most important thing I have was given to me by people just like you. It's this thing called recovery because it allowed me to live a life that I dreamt of as a child. It allowed me to look in the mirror and see a man I respect. Because I can tell you, when I was drinking and using, there was no respect for that man I saw in the mirror. I despised that man in that mirror. That man in the mirror was my dad. And I hated my dad when I sobered up. And when I made my amends to my old man, what's the first thing I did? I start to cry. What did my dad tell me? Sober, I'm proud of what you're doing. I drank like him. I treated women like him. I did everything just like him. And he never told me he was proud of me. I quit drinking. Now he's proud of me. That's how God works. I would love to say that my life is absolutely perfect, but that's not true. But what my life is today is it's perfect in God's eyes. And my only task is to coordinate my vision with his vision today. God has taken care of me and carried me through some horrifically horrendous things, sober and drunk. I survived. So it is always an honor to share. And I love to laugh and I love to make my, you know, I'm proud to be a Yaqui today, and I can honestly say when I sobered up, the last thing I wanted to be was Native. I wanted to be yellow. make me Mexican, make me white, make me anything but what I was. And that was all because of the shame that I was raised with. My dad felt my best bet would be as white as you can be. That's your best bet to have a good life. What a mistake. What a tragedy that was. I don't ever want my kids to feel that way. So I am honored and blessed to be a part of this fellowship. I am honored and blessed to be a man who loves you, who loves me, who loves God. And I am blessed to have the life that I have. It's been an amazing journey. Just don't drink, go to meetings, and everything else will work out. Thanks.
Thank you, Fernando. And here to read the Great Spirit prayers, Adam. Have a walk.
Hi, I'm Adam. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm from the Paspe Yaqui Reservation. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the wind, hear me, whose breath gives life to all the world. Hear me, I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty and make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made, and my ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise so that I may understand the things you have taught my people. Help me remain calm and strong to face all of all that comes towards me. Let me learn the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. Help me see clear thoughts and act with the intentions of helping others. Help me find compassion without empathy overwhelming me. I seek strength not to be greater than my brothers, but to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me always ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes, so when the life fades, as a fading sunset, my spirit comes to you without shame. Oh.
May I please have a hand for everyone who read today? Please help me join hands and close the meeting with serenity prayer.